Okay, so continue our reflections on mindfulness, foundations of mindfulness, and I think one of the, there's many, and of course there's many, many facets to the application and clarification of the Satipatthana, of these establishings of mindfulness. But I think one of the things that comes to mind this evening for me is the to be able to use it to direct our attention and our mindfulness to the a purpose or a result. And one of the things, this happened to me fairly early in my practice, within the first few years, and been these sort of debates and disagreements on mindfulness, and were sort of swirling around the community that I was. And then at one point, I just had this sense of a certain insight or clarity came up that, really the purpose of mindfulness and establishing of mindfulness is not to support more views and opinions, but to really penetrate the understanding of anicca dukkha anatta, just to really, and with that understanding of anicca dukkha, and particularly anatta, the sense of not self, that there's an immediate relinquishment and letting go and penetration of the kind of the peace and clarity that is possible with the Buddha's path. So that, lifting up those you, I mean, of course one cultivates these establishings of mindfulness, and these are really important tools to have available to us. But then to be really turning our attention to these the quality of our experience in the light of anicca dukkha anatta, and these are not three kind of separate discrete truths or characteristics. It depends on which way you look, then you see or experience things in the light of one or the other, or amalgamation of one or two or three. I mean, it doesn't really matter, but it's it certainly has this flavor of relinquishment, of letting go, release, when one sees that. And that's certainly in our chanting. There's a chant that we do from time to time. And it's the characteristics of wow, it opened right to it. Impermanent are all conditioned things. When with wisdom this is seen, one feels weary of all dukkha. This is the path to purity. Dukkha are all conditioned things. When with wisdom this is seen, one feels weary of all dukkha. This is the path to purity. There is no self in anything. When with wisdom this is seen, one feels weary of all dukkha. This is the path to purity. And this is when it's seen, so as opposed to conceived of or thought about or intellectualized or proliferated about, this is a function of mindfulness, is to establish a certain perspective and clarity and stability of the mind. And of course, mindfulness is never And the Eightfold Path of the Buddhas is an Eightfold Path. One can't extract one and think that that's all going to work. But mindfulness is as the Buddha emphasizes, this is a direct path for the overcoming of dukkha, and to be able to attend carefully to that, the cultivation, developing, and establishing of mindfulness, and reflecting on these different characteristics of experience, whether it's the world outside or the world inside. Just attending to its texture, its how it presents itself. And of course, Sailika Ajahn Chah he placed a lot of attention on impermanence and anicca as a doorway into freedom, both in terms of its objective presentation of impermanence, but then also anicca in terms of uncertainty. This is unsure, not a sure thing. That's sort of emotionally how we experience it, or internally in a mental sphere, how we experience things. But so that looking at things through the light of, with mindfulness as the foundation, and starting to contemplate the quality of anicca, dukkha, anatta, depending on the mood of the mind at a certain time, one or the other stands out, or by personality, one or the other stands out, different times in one's practice and different characteristics feel more important than the other. But just to recognize again that these are part and parcel of the same truth. This is the way things truly are. They're anicca, dukkha, anatta, and you can't solidify, stabilize, claim ownership on it. You can't rely on it for one's lasting satisfaction and happiness. It's just the nature of things. And that's not a value judgment. It's just the way things are. And so that not to invest in something that is not going to, it's not going to deliver. And so that, and reflecting on the just impermanence. And you can get, there's so many ways of reflecting on impermanence, or in terms of anicca, in terms of its change, its unreliability, because things do change. And even when it appears to not really change all that much, it's like thing on a geological scale, human beings are pretty insignificant, sort of hardly blips on the screen of time. There's an area in Canada where the mantle of the earth is actually pushed up to the top, and the rock formations are somewhere between 4 and 4.5 billion years old, and it's just sitting there, just part of the landscape, and it actually has changed, because it was probably thrust up through, plate tectonics or something that brought it up. But it's a very, very ancient, one of the more ancient areas on our planet that is physically visible. And geological time couple billion years here and there. I mean, those are pretty immense aspects of time. When you think of, at best, you get to be 100 years old. 100 years old as a human being is pretty puny, really. Then in historical time, just how history has there's a memory of things historically, things that happen, but you know, it's not, you know, you think, you know, where are they now? Where are the, they just even in this area here, there, you know, there's Tsudiko, early days of coming here, you know, found arrowheads in the creek bed. That's the remnants of kind of the Native Americans who used to live here. But you know, the, historically, where has that gone? It's not really a tangible part of our memory. And you know, all whatever people that were here who were out here hunting and living and whatnot, they had their lives of their own happiness and suffering, their own hopes and fears, and their own struggles and joys, and that's the you know, historically it's you know it's just a projection or a memory. It's just not even it's a conjecture of a memory. Yeah, so it's not that substantial. You know, so the sense of time is you know in terms of you know the way the mind moves, you know, moves incredibly quickly. A mood changes so rapidly, and you know, to have the mindfulness to really recognize it and not be pulled about by these impermanent, changing moods. And you think, and then you think, even on a mental level, there's you know, it's like in a subatomic world, the time is measured in attoseconds. An attosecond is a millionth of a billionth of a second, and it's the time it takes for an electron to go around a proton. And then that's but then they measure time like in a proton in zeptoseconds, which is a billionth of a trillionth of a second. And so how do you even measure stuff like that? I mean, these are but you know changes just so there's different scales. And we impute kind of reality onto it, and we can and create a sense of me within that, and we suffer accordingly, and that's the say the beauty of the Buddha's teachings is the opportunity to step away from the kind of ways that we misinterpret experience that fundamentally is impermanent, unsatisfactory, and not self. And you know what is that sense of recognizing that that because desire is constantly creating some kind of me happy. Somewhere, some other time, some other place, with some other people, somehow. Just, you know, and it's always moving out from ourselves. And it's the nature of the Buddha's teaching. When he said the nature of Dhamma is open aiko, it's leading inwards, you're drawing attention into the heart. And to draw attention into the heart, that necessity of establishing mindfulness, clarity, attention, awareness, mindfulness, having those foundations of mindfulness solidly in place. Otherwise, we get pulled into the kind of you know, the fascinating, enchanting projection that desire conjures up. It's just what desire does. You know, desire in the sense of tanha. Tanha is always a desire with a basis of greed, hatred, delusion. That's by definition, tanha is the root of dukkha, And tanha, always, it's the desire that is based in some form of greed, hatred, delusion, some kind of unawareness, lack of true knowledge. And so that it results in discontent, dissatisfaction, dis-ease, dukkha. And so that, and it isn't, and you don't sort of, and you don't have to annihilate desire, and you have to see it clearly. When it's seen with wisdom, and that's that refrain from that chant, when this is seen with wisdom, is truly seen with wisdom, one grows weary. And weary not in the sense of feeling depressed and disheartened. It's that one is just, I don't need to do that anymore. I don't need to buy into that. I don't need to invest in inordinate amounts of my attention and well-being into that. And so that that's that sense of, yeah, the enchantment is kind of broken or shattered. And that's that in itself. There's a liberation there, because of that opportunity to not be entangled. And the sense of not self, it's not me, not mine, not who I am. Recognizing the inherent insubstantiality of whatever we think is. This is me, this is mine, this time I really got it. And just seeing through that, it's insubstantial. It's a mirage, it's a conjurer's trick, that we buy into this sense of I-making and mind-making. And that's in Pali, ahankara mamankara, the eye making and the mind making. These are things that don't have a substantial reality to begin with. They have to be created. They have to be made. Have to be built up out of fabrication. So then we no longer have to believe that. So that sense of insubstantiality, or a sense of it's empty, and empty not in terms of a devoid of any meaning, but empty in the sense of it's hollow and shallow. What we thought was substantial is hollow and shallow. What we thought was me and mine. What we thought was so central to our identity as a being is quite, quite empty. And that's not a disappointment. Again, that's an opportunity for release. When you're not having to carry something, all of a sudden everything becomes lighter and more buoyant, more light, more bright. This is the kind of the beauty of that. So that sense of, I think what comes to mind is one of the suttas the Buddha talks of like the five khandhas. And this is sort of a structure that the Buddha points to in terms of what we build our sense of self and identity around, and is form, feeling, perceptions, mental formations, consciousness. These are the five aggregates of being, and that's what we identify with one or the other of them as, or a combination. You've got your pick. One or the other, a combination of something within that, or all of them all at once. And it's just, but we. This is what we think is who we are, what I am. This is me. This is mine. I am this. And the image that the Buddha gives, he said it's like a dog that is tethered to a post that's, you know, really firmly planted in the ground, and it walks around. All it does is walk around this post. And it can go one way or the other, or go back and forth, or it can lay down at the base of that post. But that's as far as it goes, and that's what we as human beings, this identification with these five khandhas, we circle around and back and forth and lay down and sleep at the foot of these five khandhas, and this form, feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness. We don't go past that, and so that the seeing clearly of the anicca, dukkha, anatta characteristic, particularly with mindfulness, as opposed to just some intellectual analysis or some kind of taking it on faith or some kind of belief in some way. It's through mindful attention that seeing, oh, this also is, this is how it is. And when it's like this, it can't be stable. It can't be permanently satisfying. It can't be a solid me or mine. It's impossible to fulfill that wish. So then this is where our sense of freedom and liberation comes in, the clear seeing, the clear knowing. And this is why mindfulness is so important in this path that the Buddha lays down. And it is so that this cultivation of these four foundations of mindfulness and any of the bases of mindfulness are a valid foundation, using the body in some way, shape, or form, having an anchor, you know, whether it's mindfulness of breathing, mindfulness of postures, mindfulness of the element, anything, but having an anchor. Same with feeling, just recognizing, these are feelings, and seeing through the establishing of mindfulness, mindfulness of the mind itself. So one is recognizing the moods as they come and go, how to work with the mental states that arise. And then the various dhammas, there's different qualities, different phenomena of experience that we can attend to in different ways, whether it's looking at the negative in order to work with it, or the hindrances, how to work with the hindrances, how to free the mind from the hindrances, how to identify them clearly, working with just neutral in terms of the five aggregates of being, six sense bases. When the Buddha describes, when he's asked, what is the world? And there was the world. The world is the six sense bases. The world is sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, mental formation. The world is the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind. That is the world. That whereby one conceives of or perceives of the world, that is the world. So that we interpret the world, again, through our biases or our habits, our conditioning. And this is what mindfulness is for us, to see that clearly. Mindfulness of the seven factors of awakening, mindfulness of the Four Noble Truths. These are cultivating the aspects that are, you know, very positive elements and uplifting qualities of the mind. It's, these are, you know, using the and learning how to use these four establishings of mindfulness, so that we're able to. I think one of was in the refrain to independent, living independent, and yeah, that freedom from relying on our imperfect and unreliable ordinary minds, and you realize, oh, there is a way through this, and but you have to follow the program to offer that for your reflection. See,
Lampa, thank you for sharing Dhamma with us. I just had a question. Is it possible to use metta as a foundation for mindfulness?
Oh, absolutely.
And like, what might that look like?
Well, I wrote a whole book on that.
So how do you, I'm the exalted immeasurable. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean it's you're uplifting the mind with using metta. Because also one of the things that you know, in that book, that I mean, basically it was a set of teachings that I gave at a retreat that I was asked to teach on the theme of metta, and you know, in the same way that I just talked about mindfulness, said there's, you know, there isn't really a you can't separate, in the same way you can't separate mindfulness out of the path of liberation, you can't separate loving kindness out of the path of liberation. It fits into the whole package. And yes, learning how to slip it in and relying on it, and you know, they're tools that we help to encourage the mind and to clarify and sharpen it.
Thank you so much for your talk. How do you know when to like switch it up?
Know to what?
When to switch it up, quote unquote.
It's through experience. You just have to learn how to trust yourself, because we're always trying. Okay, I've got to. You know, how do I be sure? As soon as you come from that place, you've already planted doubt in your mind. But so that you just do it, and say, and then you look back and say, wow, that didn't work. And then reestablish it. Or, oh wow, that really worked. Okay, what did I learn from that? And the same, so you're using the practice in order to, it's an ongoing learning practice. This is it's one of the words that comes through the teachings, and this is a training to be done, and the word is sikha, and so there's training, learning, education, and you learn from your practice, and so that like a precept in Buddhism. Is in Pali is sikkhapada, and pada literally means foot, but it basically means base or foundation. And so sikkhapada is like when you take the eight precepts or the five precepts, panatipata veeramini, sikkhapadang samadhiyami. Samadhiyami is the I undertake. Panatipata is killing living creatures. Where it needs to refrain from, and sikkhapada is the training. Undertake the training. Undertake the basis of learning, of refraining, so that you're taking it to learn from it, as opposed to conform to a commandment of some sort. Yeah. And the same with like Anapanasati Sutta. The predominant verb like there are 16 steps in the Anapanasati Sutta, and the first two steps, the predominant verb is pachanati. Thank you. It's one of the things you learn as you get older. You cannot rely on your memory. Pachanati. So which literally means to know clearly, to understand. And then when it's that's the verb form, when it's, say, turned into a gerund, turning a verb into a noun, then that is panya, is wisdom, discernment. But the rest of the 14 steps of that 16 steps of Anapanasati, the predominant verb is sikkhati. Like when we chant the Anapanasati Sutta, you see sikkhati come over, and you chant it over and over again. I will train thus. And so like I'm learning, I'm studying, I'm educating myself. So what we do with our practice, and you learn from your successes, you learn from your failures, you learn from experience. And this is an experiential teaching as opposed to a philosophical doctrine or metaphysical doctrine. This is an experiential teaching.